This is Raymond C. Ferguson interviewing J. Burton Nichols at his home. Today is Thursday, January 16th in the afternoon. In our earlier session 2 days ago, Bert, we had just begun to discuss your contributions to polymer science shortly after your arrival at DuPont. What work stands out in your mind with respect to your particular contributions to polymer science?
Well, if you consider cellulosic materials, derivatives, as original polymers, natural polymers, my work, which complemented Lansing's original work with the ultracentrifuge to set up relationships between viscosity and molecular weight so that they could have a short method of characterizing their materials. My work on the cellulose started in the 30s.
Yeah, we pause there just a minute, Bert, to be sure that our tapes are recording well. All right, you were getting into your work on cellulosics.
Yes. Cellulose itself and cellophane were, of course, difficult to dissolve, and Lansing had worked out a apparatus for dissolving cellulose in cupramonium solvent under nitrogen to exclude oxygen, and he was able to get very good reproducible results. So I continued his work mostly with the oil turbine ultracentrifuge, which was set up in 35. And there we got somewhat better idea, of course, on the uniformity of the material, that is, whether it had a narrow distribution of molecular weights or broad. I went from the centrifuge work to general characterization. I might follow that line right along and visited the various plants in producing cellulosic products such as cellophane and rayon and acetate, and to get an idea of their problems.
This might be a good time to look back at the DuPont's business at the time you came. They had, let's see, they were really already in the polymers business because they'd acquired Fairfield, the rubber company, in 1916.
Yeah.
Right, and then the cellulose.
The French technology for cellophane in 23.
23, right.
Yes.
And that was, were these plants you were visiting, DuPont plants, which had been acquired, or were they, had they been
built
using
them.
The...
No, they built, they just got the technology from the French.
Mm-hmm.
And at Buffalo, outside of Buffalo, the Tonawanda plant had, at that time, DuPont Rayon Company. It was, I think, a subsidiary portion of the company for a while. But there I met the pioneers of, especially of the cellophane. I got into the cellophane part more than the Leon.
Do you want me to take the phone or?
No, she's got it.
I might check back a little bit on this. Now, you were at visiting the DuPont plant, so.
Yes. So, I knew most of the people at Buffalo in the supervisor.
Was this somebody like Hale Charge?
Hale Charge, and I can't think of it. Hoff.
Hoff. I can always look this up. We don't have to dig this up.
HOFF.
Mm-hmm.
And the brother of R. Bradshaw, Henry. No, see, now that was Henry, I guess.
The one at Buffalo, or Towanda, was Henry.
I think
Bradshaw.
So. And well, there are a number of people there that I knew at the time. So so eventually I worked into a program on characterization, on a broader characterization of cellulose and cellophane, and spent a couple of years working on dry cast cellophane, because that being supported on a drum or other support and subjected to heat and airflow gave a two-dimensionally equal product. That is, there was not this strong machine direction and the weak transverse direction that the ordinary cellophane had those years.
Now, this the dry casting process was yours.
Yes.
That was your development and your two patents, I think.
Yes, that's right.
Came out. Explain dry casting a little bit more to me. That's something similar to what we called melt. Melt rheology, or did the cellophane actually melt?
No, no. It just decomposed my terminology gets lost, but the compound the it.
You mean you by dry heat you degraded the
brought it back to cellulose,
brought it back to
from the viscose.
Oh, I see.
That the cellulose xanthate.
Mm-hmm. Yes, cellulose xanthate.
That was the compound that
right.
was made in the preparation. So that was spread on it in a thin layer on a surface, uniform surface, and then subjected to heat. And you had to have a considerable flow of air, hot air, going over it so that the surface wouldn't, the surface would set soon enough so that it wouldn't contract and give a very hazy surface. And under those circumstances, I got relatively clear. It wasn't brilliant, but it was. You could read through it all right.
Was there some drawing involved after?
No.
After it cooled, it was just cast and used that way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so the tensile strength. I forget what they called it now. The strength went up from about 2 to, well, I could get up as high as 15.
Is this something like pounds per square inch, or was there some other tensile test used for film at the time?
It was a test that was used. You cut little samples out and drew them in the tensile machine, the Instron, yes.
Okay.
You worked then, after your work, which was the chemical department here, I assume, this work was continued on up at Buffalo?
Well, yes, that's right. And they took it through a small summer works to demonstrate the problems. The first phase was, you know, there are two things that stopped it. I guess the first one must have been the war, the Second World War, and hail charge.
Oh, no, that's interesting. You knew hail charge then.
Very well.
Through that, and I recall he had basic patents on waterproofing cellophane.
Yes, he was
sort of made the cigarette industry or the cigarette packaging industry.
Yeah, he was the fair-haired boy up there.
And that was before or after you worked with him?
No, that was during.
During. And you say he stopped your development, or he came along with something better?
He didn't see much prospect for it. It was tricky. And I think he saw the synthetic polymers coming along, because towards the start of the war they started to get some polymer film, as I recall it. I'm not sure just where that came in, but anyway, it was so easy to get these brilliantly clear, high strength synthetic polymer films when they finally were developed.
Was ICI into the polyethylene work that early?
They must have started before the war, because they bought the patent came from, I don't remember. No, the calico spinners, that was the polyester. Well, they developed this high pressure method there.
Polyethylene, high pressure polyethylene.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that was definitely, I'm sure that was before the war.
And this was developed in England, I assume.
Yeah.
Okay. While we're talking about Hale Church, you said he was a fair haired boy. I was under the impression that he was highly regarded and was a very competent man, as a matter of fact.
He was, yes.
My wife worked for him in textile fibers pioneering here at the mm-hmm. experimental station. I know she was, or everybody I knew there was very impressed with him.
Oh, yes, he was real. He took care of his people. He would stand up for them under most any circumstances and give them a fair shake. But during the early days of the, when he had sort of turned around the cellophane, made it a all-purpose material. At one time, he was sort of disappearing from Buffalo around Thursday evening, getting back Tuesday morning. So they traced what he was doing. He was going down to Mexico visiting a senorita.
Is that right?
He was a colorful. Very cool.
It seems to me his wife was not a Mexican senorita, though, when he was here.
I don't think he was married at that time.
At that time, no. But he married, I think it was a German lady or something, didn't
Could
he?
Well be. I probably met her, but
I think I met Mrs. Church once, he didn't really come to the parties I went to when I arrived, so I never really got to know him.
But he had this nice house out on Route 100, and unfortunately it burned. Yeah. I think that may have, didn't his wife die?
That I don't, don't know. You mean after he died, or this was before?
Oh, before, I thought.
Did you work with him here when he got the station?
No, by that time I was into other things. Well, I had some contact with him, but nothing, not as an associate, really.
Okay.
But then...
There, I think that may be better.
I think so. Then I got into the broader characterization of the polymers as they started to develop. So I had to set up osmotic pressure. Well, then the neoprene work came along too. So I was very closely associated with Walt Mokola in his work.
Was Walt synthesizing or characterizing the neoprene, or both?
He was doing both, I think.
I was going to try to trace back through the neoprene work with you, but let's talk. Membrane osmometry was one of the things that I knew you were involved
yes.
in. I was going to talk to you about as a,
yes,
as a development and a contribution to polymer science.
Yes. When the work blossomed, we couldn't rely on one or two cells. So we had a big aquarium. It held, I guess, close to 1,000 gallons. Maybe not, that may be an overestimate. But anyway, there must have been, 20 or 30 units there, which kept us rather busy. These are simple osmometers. A tube with a membrane on the bottom, and then he measured the height of the column.
With a graduated capillary, or
yes,
yeah.
We had a stationary. I forgot what you call the instrument unit.
Cathodometer.
Cathodometer.
Yeah.
And that we practically wore out walking it up and down.
I think Bill Remington tried to pass an old cathodometer off on me when I first came here, and I said, "What's it for? Who would want it?" That's facetious, though. How did you get? Let's see, where did the development of a membrane osmometry come? That, of course, went way back, I suppose, into the
journal. Oh, that was a long ways back.
So this wasn't a new invention in any sense?
No, it was just a means of simplifying. That is, Spurlin of Hercules did work on osmometry, and, of course, some of the original work was done in Denmark, Sorensen, mm-hmm. back in the 20s.
So you just picked up information from the literature, or or was that a part of a physical chemistry course in your graduate school days?
No, we didn't have anything like that in the graduate school.
You used cellulose acetate
membranes. We needed to have the number average from the osmotic and the weight average from the centrifuge, or later, the light scattering technique.
Yeah.
Which I was into pretty deep. Mm-hmm. In fact, we with Freddie Baum and Henry Ockley as designers and builders, we had probably the best equipment in the country for light scattering.
Now, Peter Debye really started.
He started
light scattering for polymers, right?
Yes, I knew. That in this Rayleigh scattering equation there was this volume term as a square of the volume, but he used that as a starting point to develop a good light scattering method.
Now he was at Cornell.
He was at Cornell.
This time. This would have been during the war or before?
He came over just a little before the war. He got out maybe in 38. And so in the war days, he was asked to set up a quick characterization for the synthetic rubbers that were being developed. And his apparatus, of course, was fairly crude at the time, but it did the job. And I went back and forth frequently, that is, oh, not as frequently as once a month, but I went up to Cornell quite a bit, and they built one of their units for us, which was crewed by Henry's standards.
Henry Oddie's standards.
That is, well, and Freddie Baum, especially the optical part. So they really developed it into a fine piece of equipment.
Now you did angular dependence and concentration.
Yes, I was coming to that. Of course, DeBye and Mark were closely associated on this problem, and so Mark's people, especially Doty, Paul Doty, developed an instrument. It may have been the same as DeBye's, I don't know. But anyway, I gave him a sample of cellulose acetate, which I had a good supply and which I characterized pretty well by the ultracentrifuge and the osmotic pressure. So I knew the number average was around 38,000, and so the weight average should be at least in the 70s. And when they got their first results at Brooklyn Poly on this sample, they got only about 40,000. So I knew something was wrong. And DeBye looked at these results and says, oh, you have to take into account the angular dependence. You have to extrapolate to zero angle. And that brought the results into agreement.
I see. Now, later, when I got acquainted with light scattering, the Zim plots were the way to reduce the data.
Yes, and Zim was also from Brooklyn Poly.
Zim was at Brooklyn Poly at the same time Paul Doty was, or somewhere thereabouts. Is that right?
Yeah, there was quite a crowd there. So that was a plot both of angle and
concentration.
Anyway, it was a good net.
Yeah, you had a sort of a distorted grid.
So you had a double extrapolation.
Double extrapolation on concentration and angle, as I recall.
That's right, concentration. Because you had both things to contend with. Because by that time, Florey and others had demonstrated that a single concentration didn't mean too much.
Yes. You of course, probably used solution viscosity measurements in those days, at least for a crude characterization. Whether you made a polymer or not, did you have charge of the viscosity work?
Yes, we had a big tank like that, which would hold a number of viscometers.
20-gallon tank or something like that with a thermostat.
It was probably bigger than that. Mm-hmm. Could have been 50.
How big a crew did you have doing molecular weights, say, back in the early 30s?
Well, Beverly Price was my assistant.
Beverly Price didn't come...
She came in 42.
In 42, okay.
45, I'd better say, just after the war. And Emerson Bailey was still there, I think. He left somewhere in that range and went first to Franklin Institute and then out to Denver to the Marietta. That's the first part of the...
Martin Marietta.
Martin Marietta plant, and got killed. When he started to come out onto a main road in a truck without brakes.
Now, if I recall, Emerson Bailey would work with you from
he did a lot
almost
of work,
the time you came.
A lot of the pigment work was done with him, and he together we developed this master curve so that we could get out data for any white pigment of known refractive index.
Did you publish that?
Yes, there's one paper in Industrial Engineering Chemistry. I think it's under his name only.
No. Then I probably didn't pick it up in your bibliography, but it would
but
be in the
it's
collection.
It's there. I don't know what the year it is, actually.
Okay, that would be... I can check that out. I've got the collected DuPont publications. I may be... I don't know, was there more you wanted to say about the molecular weight methods that you used or developed during your
career? That was roughly it, because, well, that light scattering work carried on for some years, and...
It was still going on in the 1950s when I arrived, and...
I had that, but along about 53, was that late? Yeah. During the war there was this period when I was interim head of the little physics department. So during that time was the exciting development of all these instruments. Again, Henry Aki and Freddie Brown.
I've got some other breakdowns that I listed for my interest. Microscopy and spectroscopy. There are two other areas, that you were in.
They developed this very, we call it crude now, but it was a very fine Raman apparatus, which they did with consultation with Rank. I think Rank was either Penn State or Michigan, but he was a good infrared man.
So now, who was it that developed this at DuPont, or was this something you purchased?
No, this was Aki and Baum, because we needed some Raman work. And Then on the ordinary infrared, that was Joe Downing. When he came, he went out to Michigan and was there for, I don't know, 6 months, we'll say, while an instrument was being built for him.
Let's see, who was at Michigan then doing that?
I was trying to think. I can't quite put a name.
I think of the IR pioneers. E. Bright Wilson built infrared at Harvard, and he had a lot of dealings with let's skip over that. It may come to me later. It may come to one or the others later, but anyway.
But anyway, he had it built, and it was installed in the dungeon. That underground had been an underground rifle range.
Oh, the sort of the ballistics fort or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, it was forty building. And so then during the war, it was too slow, because this was just an energy record. So it was photographic. It was a spark printed record. So you'd have a 45 degree slope as the background, and then you'd have to pick off the location of the bands. But that was much too slow for the work on the fluorides during the war. This was over on the atomic energy side.
Oh, these were using infrared to analyze uranium hexafluoride, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
These were gas phase analysis.
Yeah. So, Joe Downing developed a crude what do you call it? At least it subtracted the background.
Modulated. Did he double beam it, or did he modulate the?
No, it was double beam. Mm-hmm. And then Brown Instrument got in on it with him, and they had a pretty satisfactory instrument for doing these gas samples. And of course, the receiver was rather poor. I've forgotten what it was. The light, do you remember what the receiver?
Oh, they had, let's see, in the early days, I think there were thermocouples, thermopile receivers, and they didn't have the later lead, selenide. If you just use a thermocouple, that probably was insensitive.
Thermocouple, yes.
Thermopile, I think, would be an assembly of thermocouples in a small volume.
And, so then we got word through Dr. Funt, Professor Funt, that there was a development out at General Motors Laboratory in just outside of Detroit, wherever it was.
Dearborn.
That's Ford.
Ford, yeah, that's right. Pontiac.
Anyway, we had to get clearance from the Atomic Energy, General Grove, I guess it was, or Nichols, one of them, to visit the laboratory and see it. This, as I recall it, was the thermistor, which gave a much greater sensitivity. So that was installed. That helped also on.
So these this infrared spectrometer was a strict laboratory-built predecessor of any of the commercial spectrometers.
Yes.
Now you got a Perkin-Elmer Model 12C somewhere.
Yeah.
And there was that.
And we worked with Perkin-Elmer later.
I think the 12C was probably their first spectrometer, if I recall.
But we also worked with Perkin-Elmer on the development of the X-ray spectrometer. See, up until that time, it had to be photographic. So we wanted to put it on a chart and get a nice, clean record. So we worked with one of the men there, and Henry and Freddie Baum rigged up. They got an old quadrant from some place so that they could scan, go through the angles that they wanted.
I see. That's right. The X-ray scattering angle gave you a. They originally used a photodensitometer kind of plot, didn't they?
Yeah, it was a series of sharp,
right.
Pretty sharp bands.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a relief to be able to pick off from a chart rather than from a photographic record.
Now this was X-ray emission for elemental.
This was the X-ray diffraction.
X-ray diffraction.
Yes.
Oh, X-ray diffraction for crystal.
So we were working with samples from the metals research at Newport, all these new metals that they were working for various purposes, especially the pure silicon. There were a number of those and alloys that they're working on.
But this was basically the X-ray diffraction work for crystal structure and identifications.
So. Yeah, we didn't get into the more esoteric forms, which came later.
Did you get involved in X-ray fluorescence for elemental analysis?
I did not. That came later.
When you had a mission spectrograph at the experimental station when I arrived, was that used during the war, or did that come along later?
That was there for a long time. That was Berndt, wasn't it, that had that?
Robert Berndt, or Bierstadt?
Bob Berndt, yes.
Could have been Bob Berndt.
I think it was, yeah. But also, let's see now, also we got the first, let's see about the timing, when Bill Phillips came, we got into the NMR.
That would have been 1954, about.
Yeah, so that, I was just present, I had nothing to do with that.
Going back to some of these, we're talking about the infrared. You said it was gotten initially for the Manhattan Project work, or the. When did you start using it for polymers, and for instance, the neoprene?
Well, we didn't get it originally for the war work,
but
we got it for characterizing the various. Organic messes that the chemists made.
So about when did this work start then, using infrared
characterization? Well, down it came, I would think maybe around 38.
As a matter of fact, I think on the last sheet of that these charts I gave you, Joe Downing's name is mentioned. Turn it back a page. Well, I think we can always pick that up later.
Yeah,
I have it. I did note when Joe arrived, and I just don't have it right fresh in my mind.
I think these are
the. Why don't we? Switch over to the neoprene development, because that was, if I'm correct, that was really the first major polymeric product that came out of Brothers' research.
And the first ultra-sensory work we did, we were studying the emulsions. We did quite a bit of emulsion work. And that recalls that we also did quite a bit of work with the emulsions they prepared at Buffalo. That was delusterine, rayon. Yeah, they called them delusterants, but they put it on from an emulsion. So we had to compare emulsions and the properties they gave. But the first samples we had of the neoprene, or the duprene, as it was first called, were in the emulsion form, and they gave a tremendously uniform sedimentation in the centrifuge.
What do you call them, microcell sizes or whatever, droplets were usually uniform.
For an unfractionated material.
But this was an aqueous emulsion.
That was our first introduction. And then from
Just you were present there when Lionel Collins, I think, was basically the the inventor. Carruthers and Collins on the patent, or do you recall?
I don't think Carruthers was on the patent. Arnold Collins was at the station for a few years.
As I recall, he then went to Orkham.
He went over to Orkham.
Okay. And as I recall, Arnold told me one time in the lunchroom about he was talking about Carruthers and particularly about the discovery of chloroprene and the invention of and the polymerization. He was very modest about the whole thing. It sounded as if his ideas and his instructions and so on had come from Carruthers.
It's quite possible they had fruitful discussions, because Carruthers would have known of Newland's work out at Notre Dame.
Father Newland was actually at his chemical department.
He was a consultant, wasn't he?
Just a minute there.